matter, as is Justice Stacy. I believe we have pro se counsel, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I'm going to say Mr. Bill Watson. And who else do we have?
Robert Watson.
And do you want to divide your time? Is that what you intend to do? Or do you want to both?
We do want to divide our time. I wasn't sure whether the two were being heard back to back or whether we needed to consolidate our time.
I think we anticipated it would be one consolidated argument. You can have up to 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
And again, you are Mr. Watson.
I am Bill Watson.
You're Bill Watson. You may proceed.
I'm here today representing myself and my wife. We appealed the district court ruling that said we were obligated to pay the bank for something we did not sign. After receiving the appeal, the Court of Appeals determined the final order written by the plaintiff's attorney and approved by the district court judge was not a final order. There was a determination that the actions of the district court were flawed. The plaintiff, their legal counsel, and the district court decided to proceed with the flawed final order to deny us our right of a supersedes bond. They also engaged the county attorney and sheriff in taking of our Durango, selling of our Durango, and the attempt to unjustly enrich themselves from the sale. These actions under a flawed final order are clearly illegal. An illegal taking without a lawful court order. Federal felonious theft knowingly sanctioned by a federally insured national bank and their legal counsel and the district court. After the felony theft was committed, they engaged in an attempt to cover up their illegal actions. No matter how they papered it, they knowingly took our property illegally. Our attempts to protect ourselves from this lawlessness on the part of the federally insured National Bank brings us here today. We are not the ones claiming that the law does not apply to us. They are the ones who proceeded with a flawed final order. We are not the ones who committed a federal felony. We are not the ones who think they can paper over their illegal activities. We are the ones that believe that the ruling of the Court of Appeals, we are not the ones who believe the ruling of the Court of Appeals has no effect and does not need to be followed. We would ask the court to rule in our favor and protect us from this illegal behavior. We believe that using the court to carry out illegal activity is particularly reprehensible.
Mr. Watson, you were represented by counsel at the hearing on May 29, 2015, is that right?
Correct.
And at that time, none of the parties knew that the Court of Appeals would later say that the October 2014 order was not a final order. That was just not on anybody's radar at that point, was it?
Correct.
So nobody presented an argument to the district court saying that your order wasn't final, consequently you can't issue an execution or a garnishment. That simply was...
After we received the final order, the Court of Appeals ruling, we took it back to the district court, the plaintiff, and said, court has ruled that this is not a final order and you should not proceed.
And that was by the motion to vacate?
I believe so.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And you are also Mr. Watson.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm Robert Watson.
Good morning to you. And you have 5 minutes also.
Can I place this?
You may.
think it's going to be upside down that way. There you go.
I'm Robert Watson, representing myself. Underlying the seven assigned errors are two central issues. One is, did the Watsons accept these additional provisions? As you can see, this page is stark, but there is clearly a location to undersign the provisions to which none of the Watsons undersigned.
Undersigned or initial?
Initial, undersigned.
It makes no difference, you think?
The definition of undersigning is to place a signature or some sort of identification underneath the provisions themselves. Under Nebraska law, quote, a language of contract must be given their plain and ordinary meaning as an ordinary, average, or reasonable person would understand them. For all engineering, V. Charles Verana and Sons. The language of the additional provisions uses phrases like the undersigned hereby understands or the undersigned agrees and so forth.
Oh, are you arguing that because you don't have a signature on the second page, you're not bound by any of the obligations contained in that document?
No, just the additional provisions, that we aren't
on
bound
page,
to the additional provisions 6 through 13.
That are located on page 2.
That are located on page 2, referred to as the additional provisions.
Does the first page have any indication that the second page, if by signing the first page, you would be obligated to
The first page states that there are additional provisions that can be included, but then these provisions specifically say the undersigned agrees. So a reasonable person reading that would assume that they would have to undersign to agree to that. In evidence of me specifically undersigning each additional page, the other documents included in the record show me actually signing each additional page, of which I accept the additional provisions. The second major underlying issue is whether I am a party of interest for the fraud and inducement, affirmative defense, and counterclaim.
If the language on the first page includes the language on the second page, and the absence of initials is insignificant legally. In other words, if you lose on the first issue, how does that affect your second issue?
As far as the issue of fraud and the inducement?
Yes.
Fraud and the inducement, the content, no contract can be fraudulently induced and enforced in a court of law under the unclean hands, and through the theme of through being able to plead the prima facie case for fraud and the inducement.
Which contract are you asserting?
The contract that I am asserting is fraudulently induced is the June 17, 2010 promissory note. I'm not asserting that the personal guarantees was the contract that was fraudulently induced.
And doesn't this document contain waivers of those defenses?
Well, that's one of the arguments, is that no party can contractually allow themselves to perpetrate fraud on another party under public policy. It would be dangerous at best to say that a bank can write a clause that allows them to then fraudulently induce their customers into other contracts. Otherwise, if you have a personal guarantee with a bank right now, if they fraudulently induce you into another contract, you would have no defense to that. It's dangerous for all public policy throughout. So if there is any provision, that would have to be restricted if that was to be considered. I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Guthrie, good morning.
Good morning. Chief Justice, Your Honor, my name is John Guthrie, along with co-counsel Mike Cox, representing the bank in this case. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time to split up with Mr. Cox, because he'll address the counterclaim and the fraud issue somewhat also.
You may. You're going to take 6 minutes, right?
Not more than 6.
Okay.
That's my intent. I do a little like it. Let me know, please. Thank you. This case is about a contract case of guarantee, as the court's already recognized. It deals with simply the finding by the trial court that the elements of the guarantee had been met and reached by the parties in the court, whether just summary judgment in favor of the bank and guarantees. One of the issues I think that's addressed is that the guarantee provision we talked a little bit about in counsel. Mr. Watson talked a little bit about the signature page. As the court noticed, if you look, it's a one-page dot, one page, two on both sides. Specifically, in bold letters above the signature, incorporates all the terms and conditions on the second page, which are all the waivers and conditions that he's challenging and saying he didn't agree to by not signing. It also defines the undersigned as a person who signs this document, somebody who initials it. It's including the document. That's all in the specific front page that's signed by Mr. Watson.
What's the point of the little tiny lines on the second page, then?
You know, I don't know. I don't know whether it's that, if there's going to be an amendment to it, that they have to initial the amendment, or whether it's just checked to see that somebody saw it. But we did find out that at least one of the people didn't even read the document itself. Mr. Bill Watson didn't read it, so I don't know if he even saw the backside. I can't speak. The record doesn't really address whether Mr. Rob Watson did or not. Purpose, I don't know. There's no record of that. It could be to say that you saw it, but I've read that. But what I did sign was I knew those terms were incorporated. I've signed that first page. There's no way the bank would know you didn't mean what this said when you signed it. So we have to pretend that we have to inquire about whether you did that.
The gist of your argument is the first page language incorporated the second page, and the second page waives all of these claims that they're attempting to assert.
Particularly the waiver. Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. But the waiver also goes, you have to focus on who the real party in interest is. The waiver goes to claims of fraud of the borrower, who I'm guaranteeing their debt. Waiving claims of borrower, I can't make those, but it does not bar him from making a claim of fraud that induced him to sign the guarantee, which he's already just told us today. That's not what he's claiming is fraudulently induced. It was fraudulently induced to have the borrower reserve design. It's his claim. They waive that, yes, and I don't think there's anything wrong with me waiving a fraud claim by somebody else, and that's one of the fallacies in his defense. He doesn't have the standing to bring a fraud claim for reserve design. Reserve design signed the note. Reserve design extended the note 3 times, reserve design, made a payment on the note. Now he wants to articulate a claim for reserve design. He can't do that.
I'd like to turn for a moment to the other appeal that we have. And the argument that's made in brief at this level addresses something that, as near as I can tell, was never raised in the district court. And that is essentially the argument that the order back in October of 2014, despite its title of being a summary judgment, was not in fact a judgment in the sense that it disposed of the rights and liabilities of all of the parties. It was an interlocutory order, and thus it was not a judgment within the scope of the execution statute or the garnishment statute, and consequently the argument that would seem to flow from that would be any attempt to garnish or execute based on an interlocutory order would be void.
But if your question is, was that argument articulated by the other party during the hearings on those? Because we had hearings on the garnishment and the execution for the district court.
Right.
They were not. If you look at the record, I specifically remember the argument was based on this, I don't owe the debt, it's exempt, or the property's exempt from the execution, and that's the way it went forward. Not on the argument you just articulated.
Yeah, and nobody raised that argument below. And so what do we say? It wasn't raised below. It's not before us. Is it plain error? Or do you quarrel with the concept that you can't execute or garnish on an interlocutory order?
I would quarrel with the concept that it's interlocutory from the standpoint of the statute for execution being an order that simply can't be appealed right now. I can take my effect that order subject to the risk that the statute talks about of having to reverse before the final order is entered. Just remember the order, this case is sent back from the Court of Appeals, the final order is because of a fight between Mr. Rob Watson and his ex-wife, Shona Watson. It had nothing to do with the bank. We weren't in control in moving that along ourselves. Eventually
but
it got dismissed.
You would agree that under Section 25.13.15, the district court did not invoke that statute to make your October 2014 order a final judgment.
Under that statute, that is correct.
And so thus it was not within the definition of 25-1301 a final judgment?
No, I don't think it was a final judgment. I think it was a judgment or order that could be acted upon absent being stayed. I see I'm running out of time.
How would one supersede if it's not a judgment? How do you supersede from something that's not a judgment, that's not appealable?
Two applications, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Two applications were made in the way to address that. One, there was an application for a stay by the district court, which has an inherent power to do that, I believe.
And that was requested and was denied,
correct,
right?
Correct. It was requested and denied at the district court. It was requested and denied at the Court of Appeals as well.
So now, of course, I have they didn't have jurisdiction, so.
That may have been the reason they denied it. They didn't articulate why they denied it. They first denied it before they ruled on sending it back.
Yeah, okay.
But I think the court has had, you know, the appropriate method would have been in that kind of situation. We knew this was going to be an issue. We brought to the district court. They could have entered a stay with or without a bond in the court's discretion to do that, but they didn't write it. That wasn't articulated at the trial court level. So procedurally, that would be not before the court appropriate. I don't think it's a plain error because you can't find any.
Thank you.
I'm sorry I've cut into my time this time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cox. Good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Mike Cox. I represent the Cattle National Bank on the counterclaim by Mr. Rob Watson in this lawsuit. Mr. Guthrie articulated part of my argument very well, so I don't know if I could do as he did. The district court found that Mr. Rob Watson was not a real party in interest to advance his fraudulent inducement claim. Reserve Design LLC was. I argued in favor of that ruling because the evidence is clear. The note was on behalf of Reserve Design LLC. The money was used by Reserve Design LLC. Most importantly, afterwards, there were three extensions of the note, different agreements, all the way extended to September 2012, signed by Mr. Robert Watson as manager of Reserve Design LLC. Those agreements are not being attacked here with the original note, but those agreements stand on their own. All payments in the note were by Reserve Design LLC, and when Reserve Design LLC filed bankruptcy, the debt was listed on the schedules of the bankruptcy court. I don't know how at this point they can argue as anything but the debt of Reserve Design. Reserve Design is not a party to this case. It has not advanced the fraudulent conceal inducement argument, which belongs to them. In addition, the district court recognized, as was discussed earlier, that the guarantee waives any such defenses by the guarantors that they would have regarding Reserve Design, and therefore we think summary judgment is proper. If you have any questions, I will forward. If not, I'll leave any extra time for Mr. Guthrie for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
He doesn't have any rebuttal.
Do we have time for rebuttal?
He has 54 seconds.
No, Guthrie doesn't.
54 seconds, Mr. Watson.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, plaintiff's explanation of it's in bold, it's underlined, it's... That is not what Nebraska law holds. Nebraska law holds, what would an ordinary person reasonably understand by reading that document? When you read it, it says the undersigned. They place a place to undersign. A reasonable person would think that they are declining those specific provisions if they are not undersigning in that location. Second thing is the fraud inducement claim. First of all, they're using the June 17, 2010 note as their evidence that I'm not a party of interest. But under Eicher v. Mid-America Financial Investment Corp., they can't use the result of their fraud as a means to disprove that they defrauded me. Under Heritage Bank v. Bruja, quote, fraud in the inducement goes to the means used to induce a party to enter a contract. I was that party. It is my signature. All the communications were to me. And the last point I would like to make, if possible, is that I did notify the district court judge in open court that I had received an order to show cause for non-final order at the hearing. So I did give notice in the open court to the district court judge at the end of the hearing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes our arguments for the day. The court is adjourned and you are excused.